All right, folks, thanks very much for your patience. I think we're still, because we're ahead of time before, we're pretty much still on time, so that's fantastic. It's my pleasure to introduce the last news speaker for the day. Dr. Amy Sicily recently joined our faculty here in Phoenix, and we're lucky to have her. And Dr. Sicily did her undergraduate training at Brown University. She then did her medical school training at Penn. Thereafter, she did her surgical training and a research fellowship at the University of Chicago, and she did her trauma and critical care fellowship at Emory. After her training was completed, she came to Arizona for a few years in Tucson. She then went to shock trauma in Maryland, and then for the last 3 years, she's been the chief of the Division of Acute Care Surgery in Detroit at Henry Ford, and only recently did she join our faculty. She's been a passion of hers has been ultrasound since the beginning. In fact, I learned how to do FAST from Dr. Sicily back in like 1998. And she's literally trained thousands and thousands of surgeons in ultrasound and has published extensively on the subject. Dr. Sicily's talk today is on surgeon performed ultrasound and the role it has in your practice. Dr. Sicily.
Thank you very much for that. And thank you for your patience. We've been having just a few technical difficulties. It's hard to do ultrasound without videos, and so that's what part of the problem was getting the videos to work. So what I want to talk to you about is surgeon-performed ultrasound and how it might fit into the practice of a general surgeon and not just a trauma surgeon. But it all started, at least for me, and I think for most of us, in terms of surgeon-performed ultrasound with the FAST. The FAST came into prominence in the 90s, so it's been around for a while, but it was focused abdominal sonography for trauma. The thing is, what happened for a lot of us when we started using ultrasound was we realized that there were more uses for it, and we started just naturally expanding out of the trauma bay into the ICU and then onto the wards. And so what I want to talk to you about today is some of the things that are being done by surgeon sonographers. As you know, the FAST was a rapid assessment for fluid in the pericardium and the dependent portions of the abdomen. I'm not going to go over the FAST, don't worry. I'm sure everyone either knows it or doesn't have a reason to know it. But moving beyond the FAST examination, many surgeons started doing their own bedside procedures like paracentesis, thoracentesis, and of course central line placement, which back in my training day was unheard of, and now it's unheard of not to do it that way. The second thing I want to talk to you about is using ultrasound to evaluate soft tissue. I think that's one of the most underutilized aspects of ultrasound. It's really, really good for helping you find out if something has an abscess, how deep the abscess is, whether it's cellulitis, myositis, fasciitis. So we'll talk about that. And then finally, I'm going to finish up with talking about some cardiac ultrasound. And before you panic, we're not doing the full cardiology ultrasound examination. We're doing a fairly straightforward evaluation, mostly to ask the question, is the patient wet or are they dry, which is the question that most of us run into with postoperative patients with difficulty, with hypotension, low urine output, and it's unclear what we need to do. All right, so first of all, ultrasound evaluation of pleural fluid. So that's called the FAST plus two because basically you just take the FAST exam, your right upper quadrant transducer and your left upper quadrant transducer, move up a rib space, and you're looking at the base of the lung. And although it's true that you can find hemothorax that way, you can also find pleural effusions that way, which can come in handy. So this is a chest x-ray of a typical patient in the ICU lying prone, I'm sorry, supine, and they get a chest x-ray, and it looks a little fuzzy. So what is that? Is that fluid layering out posteriorly? Or is that atelectasis, or what? Hard to tell. So you get the ubiquitous, inevitable CAT scan, which shows you that actually it's a little bit of both. You've got some posterior atelectasis on those lungs, but you've also got some fluid. You could have made it easier for yourself, saved yourself the CAT scan, the trip to the scanner, and the money, the cost of doing the CAT scan if you simply ultrasound the patient right at the bedside. And here is what fluid in the lung looks like. It's a black stripe. Here's the kidney, here's the liver, this bright white stripe is the diaphragm, and here's the lung. And you get this black triangular stripe that represents fluid. Remember, fluid is black and ultrasound air is white. So you could figure out that the patient does have a pleural effusion that way. And remember that since ultrasound is both diagnostic and therapeutic, you can take care of that pleural effusion if you need to at the same time and under ultrasound guidance. The important thing about ultrasound is that it's visualization and real-time imaging. It's portable, so you can perform it at the bedside, and avoiding transport of critically ill patients, and it's repeatable if necessary. So let's talk about some interventional ultrasound in the acute setting. Thoracentesis, paracentesis, and central line placement. These are all direct offshoots of the FAST exam, right? We're basically looking in the patient's abdomen for blood, and now we're looking in the patient's abdomen for ascites. We're basically looking in the patient's chest for blood, and now we're basically looking for pleural effusions. So talk about thoracentesis first. Excuse me. As I said, this is part of the FAST plus two, where you just put your transducer up a rib space. And this is what a normal one looks like. This is the kidney. This is the liver. That's the diaphragm. And that gray, white stuff is lung. Remember, ultrasound doesn't transmit through air, so any air-filled structure will not have a good ultrasound image. And this is what a pleural effusion looks like. So liver, bright white stripe is the diaphragm. Here's the lung. This is a bigger one than the one I showed you previously. And then we've got a really big one where here's the diaphragm, here's the liver, here's the tip of the lung, and it's easier, like most things, to see it when it's moving. And so when you take an ultrasound of this, that's what it looks like. The tip of the lung is literally fluttering in the fluid, and it's pretty obvious. So not really a hard diagnosis to make. And then using the ultrasound, you can put a mark on the chest where you want to perform your thoracentesis. We call this the indirect method, where you use the ultrasound, you put a mark, and then you take the ultrasound away. You prep and drape the area and do your paracentesis or thoracentesis where the mark is. The direct way is to actually watch the needle go in. But with a big pleural effusion, it's not really necessary. And there are kits like this. And there we go on our mark. So it's all really very simple. You take care of the whole thing yourself. No need to send the patient down to radiology. No need to wait for the time to send them down to radiology. All right, next up, paracentesis. Very similar, and it's similar to the FAST. We're just looking for a different kind of fluid. This is an abdomen with a very large amount of fluid in it. And you can tell because normally you don't see bowel. Because bowel is filled with air, it just looks like gray, amorphous nothingness. So anytime you can see the outline of loops of bowel, you know the only way that can happen is if they're surrounded by water or some kind of fluid. So this would be a great place for you to stick your paracentesis needle. And as I said, you could either do it by putting a mark on the skin right by there and putting your needle in, or you could actually watch your needle go in. And indications for this would be assessment of sudden hypotension that's unexplained, persistent metabolic acidosis, follow-up of a patient with a solid organ injury that you were non-operatively managing. As I said, detection of ascites or detection of an intra-abdominal abscess. You can actually see when fluid is loculated, and that tells you that it's probably an abscess. And then finally, central line placement, which I think most of you are probably familiar with, or at least your residents are familiar with it. This is the systematic review Cochrane database findings. Ultrasound guidance with central lines is absolutely recommended as standard of care at this point. It allows exact identification and location of both the artery and the vein, prevents inadvertent arterial injury, decreases the risk of both hemothorax and pneumothorax statistically, allows assessment of patency, increases efficiency, meaning you get more first-time sticks and they come faster, so it takes you less time to do it, to do the line placement. And so that's the reason why it's become the standard of care. This is compared to the landmark technique, which is what those of us who are a little bit older learned when we were residents, so to do a subclavian or to do an IJ. And it allows post-procedure imaging as well, so you can use the ultrasound to see that the line is in the vessel that you're hoping that it's in. Here's an example of doing this on someone. Most commonly, we use the internal jugular veins with this technique. And again, you can watch your needle go right into the vessel. And this is what it looks like. There's an IJ and there's a carotid. You tell the vein easily because it's collapsible, so if you just push very gently, it'll collapse down, and that's how you tell the difference between the artery. I did want to point out to you, too, though, that it is possible to do a subclavian under ultrasound guidance, although less commonly done. A lot of people find it a little strange because compared to the landmark technique, you end up very, very lateral. So your needle is actually going to go in way over here on this side as opposed to there, which it would do with the landmark. But it is possible to do it. I personally use the ultrasound just to make sure that the vessel is patent, because there's nothing more annoying than spending 45 minutes trying to get a subclavian and then realize the patient's got a clot, and that's why you couldn't do it. So in my patients, I'll make sure the vessel's patent, particularly if they've been in the ICU for a while with multiple lines, and then I stick it using the landmark technique. But the recommendation is that we try and do it with ultrasound guidance. And this is what it looks like. Subclavian artery, subclavian vein. Unfortunately, it is not possible to do the compression trick under the clavicle because you can't necessarily compress the vessel. So you have to turn on your color Doppler and see what the flow is like. And then I wanted to talk to you a little bit about soft tissue. As I said earlier, I think ultrasound evaluation of soft tissue is really, really valuable, but it's also really underutilized. I don't know too many people who do it. And it's really pretty simple, much easier than many of the other forms of ultrasound that we're using. Soft tissue infections in particular can be difficult to assess by physical examination. The presence, depth, and extent of the infection are better defined with ultrasound. So if you're in the ER and you're seeing somebody with some kind of cellulitis and you want to know, is there an abscess there, you can find out in about 15 seconds flat by putting an ultrasound transducer on it. And you can tell how deep it is as well. Surgical decision-making is therefore streamlined. So you can tell if something's superficial, you can tell if something's loculated, you can tell if something's subfascial. And so it just makes your life easier. And keeping in mind that this is usually in the ER, and almost every ER has ultrasound machines hanging around at this point. The advantages of ultrasound-directed needle aspiration of a soft tissue infection are that you can localize collection, obviously. But more importantly, you can ensure its complete drainage. So if you're draining a breast abscess, say, with a needle aspiration technique, you can make sure that you've got all of the fluid. You can delineate the fascia precisely, so you can evaluate for fascial dehiscence, for example, as well as for a subfascial abscess. And you can also identify and remove foreign bodies. And I'm going to show you examples of all of those things. So here's your patient. You have to differentiate. You're called to evaluate this patient, and you're looking at this leg, and you're saying, is that cellulitis? Is there an abscess in there? Is it just a phlegmon? Do I need to cut it, or do I need to treat it with antibiotics? Or is it something worse? She's obese. It might be the beginnings of necrotizing fasciitis, and you might need to do something more radical. And it would be nice to know that ahead of time for operative planning, and it would also be nice to be able to tell the patient ahead of time. So here are some examples of ultrasound of soft tissue. This is the top, or the skin, and this goes deeper. So you can see here, there's skin, here's fascia, this is subcutaneous fat, here's muscle, and this puddle of blackness is fluid. So you know you have an abscess, but you also know that it's superficial, and you also know that it's not loculated. So you can make clinical decisions about what you want to do about that. Do you want to try and aspirate it? Do you want to drain it at the bedside? Or do you need to take it to the operating room? Potentially, you could do it at the bedside. This one's a little deeper. If you look, you can see that here's the skin. Here's the subcutaneous tissue. And it does have a fluid collection in it. But notice this. So that means it's loculated. And then here's fascia. And then here's a whole other fluid collection. And this is definitely not homogeneous. It would be a solid black puddle if it were. So this is either a loculated abscess or a hematoma, which you could determine by looking at the clinical picture. So let's talk about how you differentiate cellulitis, myositis, and fasciitis. I found this to be one of the most useful things with ultrasound of soft tissue because it enables you to figure out what your operative planning is going to be. And with necrotizing fasciitis, as you know, you can end up with a much more extensive dissection than you were intending. So this is cellulitis. It's superficial. Black is fluid, right? So you see this pattern of black stuff in here. It's called cobblestoning in the ultrasound literature, but basically it just means there's edema here. This is myositis, because here's the fascia, but this cobblestoning pattern is now in what must be the muscle, since it's under the fascia. So that's a deeper infection and more serious. And then finally, fasciitis. Here's the fascia. You see the disruption of the nice, you know, bright stripe of the fascia. And the reason is because there's fluid above it and there's fluid below it. And these bright, white, sparky things are air. So when you see a picture like this with edema, air below the fascia, you know you're in serious trouble. And that you can actually take the ultrasound and go out along the limb or wherever it is and figure out where the margins of that are going to be, and so you can get a better idea of how much of that you're going to have to debride. This unfortunate gentleman had a tooth abscess. This is his neck. So we were worried, obviously, about Ludwig's angina, and the question was, is this just cellulitis? Should we just treat it with antibiotics, or is there actually fluid in there? In which case, we maybe ought to take him to the operating room. And you can see that there is. Now, I will tell you, this is an old case because I haven't seen it since, but it was quite useful, and you can visualize anything in the neck, including the trachea, using ultrasound. And then finally, the Fry paper mentioned foreign bodies. Foreign bodies are simple. And the reason they're simple is because they're dense. They create an acoustic shadow. So you don't, just like you see with a gallstone, you see a black trail behind wherever the foreign body is, so you can tell where it is. And this is fascia, so it's pretty deep. So you might have to, you might not be able to dig that out. At the bedside, you might need to take that patient to the operating room, particularly if this happens to be a needle in an IV drug abuser. You don't want to be digging around in there. This is actually not. I had to create this one for myself, and this is a cadaver, and we stuck a splinter in him and then did an ultrasound exam. And then the other thing you can look at is fascial integrity, because you can see the fascia so well with ultrasound. So if you're worried about wound dehiscence or hernias, you can see when the fascia breaks. You can see there's no fascia here. And so you can tell that if this is your incision, that there's a dehiscence going on. Or you could try a case like this. Let's say you have a 56-year-old male, 5-day status post left inguinal hernia repair with mesh, of course, and he presents to the ED, and you get called to see him for redness, swelling, pain, but he's not having any fevers. How do you know what to do? I know what you do. You get a CAT scan, but it's easier, and you could do it yourself. All you have to do is walk over, pick up the ultrasound transducer, and put it on there. And what do you see? Well, he's kind of a big guy. So this is skin, and all of this is subcutaneous adipose tissue. And then here's fluid, here's mesh, here's fluid. So you're in trouble. You've got fluid on both sides of your mesh. You might have a seroma, but you probably have an infection, an infected mesh there. When you see fluid on both sides of the mesh, it's usually not going to be a seroma. All right, so finally, I'd like to talk to you about surgeon-performed echocardiography. It's a little bit controversial, but it's becoming more and more common. Here's why, and it sprang out of the trauma critical care community. As well as the anesthesiology community, as well as the pulmonary medicine community, but basically the critical care folks. There's a body of literature that indicates that early crystalloid resuscitation, which we have done for so many years so aggressively, adversely affects outcome in patients. So this idea that we have in our head of, that we flood the patient initially doesn't necessarily hold up. And then restrictive fluid resuscitation in combination with damage control resuscitation, time for adaptation was a paper that was put out by Duke et al., which showed that permissive hypotension and restrictive fluid resuscitation actually resulted in better outcomes. So it's kind of like the pendulum swinging. You know, we used to flood the patients, and now we're going to run them dry, and then 20 years from now we'll be flooding them again. But one of the questions becomes, how do you evaluate these patients to make sure that they're not too dry? Well, here's more literature. Hematocrit, systolic blood pressure, and heart rate do not actually predict hemorrhage control in surgery patients, and that's what we look at all the time, right? So how do you know when you have adequate resuscitation? Here's another one on the value of traditional vital signs, which wasn't resulting in improved outcomes. Somebody even questioning here if heart rate is a vital sign, which would be news to your medical textbook. And does tachycardia correlate with hypotension after trauma? The answer to that was no. So we're basically a little bit in the dark here. We're flying blind because all of our traditional ways of looking at resuscitation, our traditional resuscitation endpoints have been called into question. So you could do CVP. That got to be popular for a while. But the problem with CVP catheters is they have a pretty high incidence of complications, including hematoma, arterial puncture inadvertently, pneumothorax, and all of these that are listed. And here's the other problem with CVP. It doesn't work. So there's a really, really poor relationship between CVP and blood volume, if that's what you're using it for, as a measure of adequate resuscitation or as a measure of fluid status. So, you know, in a one particular study, the correlation between CVP and the actual fluid volume status of the patient was no better than tossing a coin. And then our friend, the pulmonary artery catheter, gone with the wind, right? Primarily because of articles like this in the New England Journal of Medicine, which showed that there was an increased risk of PE in the SWAN group, but no difference in mortality or length of stay. So they were actually doing harm. And that's when they began to be phased out. Also, problem with pulmonary artery catheters is in a survey of 1,095 physicians who thought they knew how to use a Swan-Ganz catheter, a third of them incorrectly identified the PA occlusion pressure, which is the wedge, which is sort of basic. So not only do they not really help us, part of the reason they don't help us is because we don't know how to use them properly. So we tried Vigileo, which is dynamic changes in arterial waveform derived variables. Good correlation in patients receiving mechanical ventilation in 29 studies that were combined in a total of 685 patients. But there was poor correlation if there were arrhythmias, which is a lot of patients, if there was obesity, which is a lot of patients, or if they were spontaneously breathing. So basically, the Vigileo was really good for healthy, young, skinny people who are unconscious on a ventilator, pretty much. So there's a gap. So what we decided to do, or what we started to develop, was the idea of looking at the inferior vena cava to see if that would give us an indication of what the volume status was. And so my colleague, Paula Ferrata, who was once my fellow, has done a lot of literature on this, qualitative assessment of inferior vena cava, where she found that it was a useful tool for the evaluation of fluid status, and also a flat inferior vena cava is an indicator of poor prognosis in trauma and acute care surgery patients. Flat meaning empty, and therefore the patient is either volume depleted or hemorrhaging. So out of all of that came something called the BEAT exam. It's also sometimes known as LIGHT, ECHO LIGHT, and FREE. I don't even remember what FREE stands for, but you can tell the fact that we have so many different acronyms for the same thing kind of indicates that we're still in the process of developing it and standardizing it. So the BEAT, anyway, stands for Cardiac Index Estimates, Effusion Assessment, meaning pericardial effusion. Area is the A, so ventricular size and ventricular function. how well the ventricles are beating, and then tank is the T for preload estimates, and that's going to have to do with the size of the inferior vena cava and how much it varies during respiration. So the beat has basically got four views. The first is called the parasternal window long axis, and you can see on the patient, you're in about the fourth intercostal space, pointing towards the patient's right scapula with your dot on your transducer. And if you do that, this is what you're looking at. And this is what your ultrasound's going to look like. You're mainly looking at your left ventricle, okay? Your right ventricle is up here. And then here's the left ventricular outflow tract. And here's the atrium and the mitral valve and the aortic valve. So you can see all of that with this view. And primarily what we use it for is to evaluate how the ventricle is moving. Whether the ventricle is kissing, meaning it's so empty that it's squishing together, or whether it's doing this, meaning it's not beating at all, or whether it looks normal. So these are actual ultrasound pictures. So here's your atrium, there's your mitral valve, left ventricle. Right ventricle doesn't show up very much. If it does, there's a problem because your right ventricle should be much smaller than your left. So when PAVIA students have congestive heart failure or have just had a pulmonary embolus or something to make their right ventricle big, you'll see it bulging in here on this view. And here's the aortic valve and the outflow tract. But primarily what you're looking at is these walls to see how well they move. All right. So, I'm going to tell you that this is normal, okay? Now, you tell me, having no experience at all, is this normal? Who says yes? Raise your hand. Normal? No? Okay. You're right. Look at the edges of the ventricle actually kissing each other. Okay, that's an indication that the ventricle is empty. Usually what that means is the patient needs volume. But beware, because remember that in sepsis, because the systemic vascular resistance is decreased, you can get a hyperdynamic heart like that even when the patient's volume status is normal. Okay? So just keep in mind, you have to eliminate the possibility that it's doing that because there's no resistance to flow. And then finally over here, is this normal? No. Okay, is it moving too much or too little? Too little. Okay, so you can see those ventricle walls hardly moving. The point I'm making here is that you, who presumably have no experience doing cardiac ultrasound, do not have a hard time differentiating those things. All you have to do is get an idea in your head of what is normal, and then you can tell, just sort of by eyeballing it, what is too much movement, what is hyperkinetic, and what is too little movement, hypokinetic. And you don't have to get any fancier than that, okay? So there are measurements that we make, you know, measuring the distance between the ventricles during end diastole and then during end systole and calculating the difference and all that kind of stuff, but you can really do it pretty much just by looking. There have been studies that have been done that have shown that with a little bit of experience, and that's 8 hours of training, surgeons can guesstimate whether or not a heart is moving normally as well as cardiologists. So it's not a tough thing to do. All right, the next view that we do is the parasternal window short axis view, and that is done by simply turning your transducer 90 degrees. So you were pointing that way before, now you're pointing this way. So you're just looking at it from a different angle, and what you're doing is you're looking at the left ventricle sort of butt on, almost like a CAT scan would. So that you can see, again, what the volume is, you can see how well it's contracting. So let's try this again. That's normal. Notice the papillary muscles, which you can see. See them? Little ears sticking up. And this is up here is the right ventricle. This is the left ventricle. Okay. Normal or not normal? Not normal. It's not hard to tell, right? And again, it's the short axis view of the long axis view that we showed where the ventricular walls were kissing. And here you can see, maybe even a little better, that in fact that entire ventricle is closing down on itself with every beat. So it's a very empty heart, or it's a patient with very little systemic vascular resistance. Okay, not moving much, right? And again, this is the short axis view of the long axis that we saw where the heart was barely moving. And notice here on this one, you can see that the patient has pretty significant pericardial effusion. So you have to start thinking about whether there's a tamponade phenomenon going on there. You're not going to see it on this view because cardiac tamponade mostly involves the right side of the heart. You see the right side of the heart collapsing first, the right atrium and the right ventricle bulging into the left side of the heart. But the left side of the heart will usually stand up to it. Okay, so again, my point is this is not hard to eyeball. And it takes like 2 seconds to get these views. So you can get a significant amount of information about what's going on with your patient. All right, the third view is called apical because we're looking at the apex of the heart. So we're over here. It would correspond to the PMI on your physical exam if you could feel it. That's where you're putting your transducer. And this is the view that you're looking at. What you'll see is what we call the four-chamber view because you see all four chambers, unlike the other parasternal views that we were looking at. And the left ventricle is on your right, and the right ventricle and right atrium are on your left. So it's like stage right and stage left. What you do is you can get a really good view of the interventricular septum, so you can see what size these two guys are relative to each other. So if your patient had a sudden PE, you'd expect the right ventricle to get big, and you'd expect the septum to start bulging that way. So you can tell a fair amount just by looking at those two chambers. And this is what it looks like in real life, only a really, really pretty one, which they don't always come out that way. Here's the apex of the heart, left ventricle, left atrium, right ventricle, right atrium, interventricular septum, and the valves. There's something called a five-chamber view as well, where if you tilt the probe just a little bit more, you're going to see the left ventricular outflow tract show up right there. And that's how you measure cardiac output, which we're not doing, because we're going to keep it simple. So take a look there. See a line of fluid right here? So he's got pericardial effusion. And, sorry, let me start this again. His right ventricle is a little bit crushed. See how it's getting pushed that way? So you gotta worry about whether or not there's tamponade going on with that, kind of an ultrasound picture. And this one, I labeled it for you, so I guess I can't quiz you on whether this is normal or not. It is not. You can see it's not moving well. But again, it's not difficult to tell that there's something wrong there. And then the final view is the subcostal window, which all of you probably remember from the FAST, or at least if you ever did a FAST, because it's quite similar. And the subcostal window will give you also a four-chamber view. It's just not as nice as the one that's apical. But if you can't get the apical, this is an alternative for you to get. So left ventricle, left atrium, right ventricle, right atrium. Okay. And you can measure, you can't get the outflow tract from this angle, so you can't really measure cardiac output, but you can certainly see how well the ventricles are moving and the relative sizes. So this right ventricle is much smaller than the left ventricle. That's normal. It should be not more than about a third as big. And this is another picture of one in real life. This view can be difficult to get because you have to go up under the xiphoid and you have to turn your transducer sideways. And so sometimes it doesn't fit. If the patient's got a narrow costal margin, or if the patient's obese, or if the patient's in pain and doesn't want you to push there. And particularly, I find it problematic in patients who are post-op with a midline abdominal incision. They very rarely will tolerate you ramming an ultrasound transducer up under their xiphoid process. So let's take a look. So this is normal. I'll just give it away. This is not normal, primarily because of this. Pericardial effusion. This is the classic view in the FAST that we invented to look for pericardial fluid, and you can see why it's a great way to see it. I'll play it for you again. See black stripe of fluid, right? So you get white line, black stripe, white line, instead of a single white line. Now there's another way to use the subcostal, and I mentioned it to you previously. This is how we're gonna get a look at the inferior vena cava, because you can see from the normal subcostal view here, the inferior vena cava is nowhere in sight. So if I want to look at it and measure it, I'm going to have to turn my transducer 90 degrees. You can use either the cardiac transducer or the abdominal transducer, but it's easier with the cardiac transducer. And if you do that, here's what you're looking at. Again, you have to look up under the xiphoid, but not nearly as far as you did with the other view, this transverse subcostal view, because here's the heart. You're not even trying to see four chambers of the heart. You're trying to see this, which is the inferior vena cava. And the reason that you want to see it is because you want to see what size it is, and you want to see what it does as the patient goes through their respiratory cycle to give you an idea of their volume status. So here we have a normal inferior vena cava. So you can tell with inspiration and expiration, it gets narrower through here. Okay. If the patient is intravascular volume depleted, it closes all the way. Goes flat. Do you see it? And then if the patient is either volume overloaded or has some other reason to have high intrathoracic pressure, like has a PE or is on very high ventilator settings, you get what's called IVC plethora, where it doesn't move at all with respiration. So this can be a very helpful way of determining somebody's volume status. So if you see this picture in someone who's not making urine, it's not because they're intravascular volume depleted. But we can make it a little bit more precise by going into M mode, which is just a button that you push on your ultrasound machine, and you get a stripe. This is the cava, and here's the respiratory variability. It gets narrower here, wider here. You can measure these. It shouldn't drop by more than 50% if your volume status is normal. And this is someone who is dry, right? Because it's collapsing all the way, or almost all the way, with their inspirations. So I find this to be probably one of the best ways to figure out somebody's intravascular volume depletion quickly. So for us, surgeons, the primary function of doing the beat or doing the cardiac analysis is to try and figure out what is the volume status of the patient. You can get fancier and do all kinds of Doppler color flow through the valves and look for regurgitation. I leave that to the cardiologists. In the middle of the night at 3 a.m., when my patient's hypotensive and not making urine, I just want to know, are they wet or are they dry, so that I can figure out what to do. And you can do it, as you see, I think, pretty easily. So in summary, surgeon-performed ultrasound allows both diagnostic and therapeutic intervention by us, which is what makes it so handy. It's fast, it's portable, and it's repeatable. So you can spend an evening taking care of a patient and check their volume status continuously. If you're giving them a fluid bolus, you can come back and look again and see if their cava is still flat. And it's definitely here to stay. It's been 25 years. I don't think it's going away. The radiologists have not managed to get us to stop doing ultrasound because it's just too useful. Thank you very much.
We just have to do just a couple minutes of technical rearrangement here, so just hang tight. While we're doing that, I want to remind you, you should all have this in your possession. This is the key to your CME. It also has the evaluation that is crucial for planning this activity in the future. It also has the questions that you need to answer, and I recommend that you sort of look at them after each talk. So it